sooner or later, you can bet your life that every Jew in this building is going to say the same thing. He's a little too Jewish for my taste.
Shalom, and welcome to the Two Jewish Radio Show with Rabbi Sam Kohan and friends, a weekly serving of everything Jewish. We'll have a great hour together today of news, music, comedy, and conversation. Our guest this morning on Two Jewish is Rabbi Ann Brenner, author of the classic Morning and Mitzvah book, which has just come out in a revised 25th anniversary edition. We'll also have visits from our expert on the international Jewish scene, Tom Price, and our two Jewish maven on Israel, Amir Eden, and our young Shinshiniot, Ron Benicote, and Rotem Rappaport. Please email your comments to us at twojewishradio18@gmail.com or visit us on the web at twojewishradio.com. And now, here's Rabbi Sam Kohan and Two Jewish.
Shalom. This is the first Two Jewish show of the secular year 2019, and we're delighted to continue to bring you the finest in Jewish radio on a weekly basis, and even a solar new year is reason to rejoice in that. Frankly, we'll use any excuse to celebrate pretty much any holiday, Jewish or otherwise, around here, but we are now entering the mostly holiday-free period of early January and are thus forced to actually think and talk about non-festival-related matters. Fortunately, I know this will shock you, we still have a few things to talk about. First, since we are very early in this new American year, it's appropriate at the beginning of all new things, even secular things, to offer a blessing. As you probably know, in Judaism, there's a blessing for everything. This is a Shehecheyanu, the prayer for beginnings, as sung by cantor Yitzchak Meir Helfgott, along with a group of other singers, blasting through a version of Meyer Machtenberg's setting of the bracha for all good new things. Thank you, God, for giving us life, sustaining us, bringing us to this new secular year. That was, among others, cantor Yitzchak Meir Helfgott singing the Shehecheyanu for the new secular year. You know, for many Americans, this beginning period of a year is a time when we try to fulfill New Year's resolutions, which mostly focus on losing a couple of pounds or getting in better shape or paying off all the bills we amassed buying holiday presents for one another. Good goals, but perhaps this 2019 year we might try a different approach to New Year's resolutions. You see, the problem with New Year's resolutions is that, however good our intentions are when we begin January, by the end of the month, or at least by mid-February, we are usually trying very hard to revive failed resolutions, or even try again. We may even have given up on resolutions altogether. It should come as no surprise. January is the month when the greatest percentage of new health club memberships are purchased. That goes for yoga studios and CrossFit gyms, too. And February is when the largest percentage of those shining new memberships lapse. Frankly, it's hard to change our lives for the better. And if that's the case, how much harder must it be to change society for the better? And yet, that is just what we are commanded as Jews to try to do each and every day, and of course each and every year. So as we begin 2019, now less than a week old, rather than a set of New Year's resolutions for our own lives, which we may or may not be able to put into action, how about making one collective resolution for our society in this still pretty shiny new year? My recommendation is a simple one. It's based on the chaotic and often violent public events of the past 12 months. Let's resolve, each of us, that we will all try to find out the actual, factual truth about situations before making up our minds about them. That is, we will not simply believe what our worst instincts urge us to assume, nor will we hear a story and jump to crazy conclusions just because our own biases lead us to them. In Judaism, we are commanded to seek truth, and God is understood to be a God of truth who desires emet, truth. Instead of pursuing weird conspiracy theories or allowing our basest motivations to shape our understanding of the world, let's find out as much as we can about the reality that each crazy news story we hear and every weird rumor that's circulating on social media or email or the internet, let's find out as much as we really can about what's real. We are told in Judaism and in other religions that the truth will set us free. I'm not sure that's always true, but it certainly is preferable to living under a cloud of falsehood, fabrication, or foolish fantasy. Let's try to be honest and open in our own lives, but let's also hold our society and its professional and amateur interpreters to a higher standard of truth in 2019. It will make all of us more responsible and make our society, ultimately, much better. Isn't that a New Year's resolution that you can all get behind this coming secular year? To play us in a little bit more on this first Two Jewish Show of 2019, here's a song from Josh Warshawski on exactly this idea. It's called Emet, Truth. In truth, the prayer says, you are first, from the weekday liturgy. Josh Warshawski's Emet, Truth, for a new secular year dedicated, we pray, to greater truth and honesty. Our guest this morning on Two Jewish is Rabbi Ann Brenner, author of the classic book Morning and Mitzvah, which has just been re-released in a newly revised edition for its 25th anniversary. She'll help us understand how to cope with tragedy in our own lives, including the sudden catastrophic events that seem to be occurring so frequently these days. All that when we return in a moment, right here on Two Jewish.
There's magic in the air at this special place for fun. A place where fortune smiles and Tucson comes alive. This is Casino del Sol. The best games in town. Amazing dining and top-flight entertainment. This is a heart that beats with excitement, with passion and beauty. It's all waiting for you at Casino del Sol. This is the soul of Tucson. Presenting sponsor of University of Arizona Basketball, Enterprise of the Pascua Yaqui Tribe.
We are delighted to welcome to Two Jewish our guest this morning. Rabbi Ann Brenner is not only a rabbi, but a licensed clinical social worker with tremendous experience in counseling. the third edition, brand new release, actually, from Jewish Lights Publishing, of her classic Morning and Mitzvah, but modified for our day, a tremendous resource on grief and mourning, has just been published. Good morning and welcome to Too Jewish.
Well, thank you. Thank you for the nice things you said about Morning and Mitzvah.
You know, this book has been around for a while, and Morning has been around for a very long time. I always appreciated the approach you took, which is comprehensive but accessible and incorporates a lot of really beautiful spiritual elements. What has changed in the way that you felt the need to address grief and mourning in our world today?
Well, you mentioned spiritual elements, and I think that what has really changed is in 1993, not everybody was comfortable talking about spirituality or even saying the word God. I think that as a culture, we've evolved. And so in this edition of the book, I much more directly look at the spiritual challenges of grief and the spiritual transformation, which is pretty much essential to really having a full grief experience and a real transformation.
One of the powerful things about the approach in Morning and Mitzvah is your focus on exercises, on sort of specific ways of dealing with things. How does this help people?
Well, I think people need someone to hold their hand. Not to tell them what they should do, but to create a place in which the experience of grief can play itself out. I think there's no accident that in the blessing that we give to mourners, which is actually the descendant of the blessing that was given to mourners when the temple was still standing in Jerusalem, the word for God is Hamakom
Yinachem
Etchem. The place.
Yeah.
That's right. That's the blessing, and what it's saying is, a mourner needs a place, and may they find a place of comfort, and may they know that that place is holy. So by creating these exercises where people can explore different aspects of their grief experience, I feel like I'm creating mekamot, that's the plural of makom, and in which they can do the work of transformation that only happens when we begin to express ourselves fully.
We will talk much more with Rabbi Ann Brenner in particular, not only about her book Morning and Mitzvah, but about some of the recent tragedies and how Jewish approaches can help in dealing with the kinds of traumatic events that we've seen so frequently in the past year. When we come back in just a moment here on Too Jewish. Congregation Beit Simcha, House of Joy, a new Jewish synagogue recently relocated into the Catalina foothills, is celebrating its first services, classes, and events this winter. Established by a group of passionate, caring congregants and me, Rabbi Sam Kohan, Beit Simcha is dedicated to create a vibrant community that strives every day to serve God with joy. As a new progressive congregation in the foothills and northwest Tucson, Beit Simcha is open to all throughout the metropolitan area and provides weekly Shabbat services, youth and adult education courses, social justice opportunities, outreach, and cultural Jewish programming in northwest Tucson and the Catalina foothills. We are thrilled to announce Beit Simcha has a new home, 3001 East Skyline Boulevard, on the northeast corner of Skyline and Campbell, just across from La Encantada. Services, classes, and events are all held here this winter and spring. Join us this Friday night at Skyline and Campbell for Beit Simcha Shabbat services, 6:30 p.m., or Saturday morning at 9 a.m. For more information about Congregation Beit Simcha and to attend services and Adult Education Academy courses and religious school, go to www.beitsimchatucson.org. That's BEITSIMCHA, Tucson.org. Or call 520-276-5675. That's 276-5675. Or go to beitsimchatucson.org. Join me in the newest Jewish community in Southern Arizona at its exciting beginning. Do you you know someone who personally made a major difference for the whole Jewish people, an individual who's done important work for Klal Yisrael and deserves to be highly recognized for that effort? As president of the Kohan Memorial Foundation, I'm grateful that the modest cash awards we started more than 10 years ago have grown into a substantial amount of unrestricted funds given to winners, with the help of donors like many of you. The foundation, named for my grandparents, Rabbi Samuel S. Kohan and Irma Kohan, makes these awards for important service to Klal Yisrael, the entire Jewish people. That service can be in one of four activities: unity, education, creative arts, or rescue. Past Kohan Award recipients are remarkable people who've done outstanding work. If you know someone who qualifies for a Kohan Foundation Award, please go to kohanaward.com, kohanaward.com, and fill out the simple nomination form. That website is kohanaward.com. Nominate an individual or donate yourself. Do it for the whole Jewish people. We welcome back a randomly occurring Too Jewish segment, Haikus for Jews, our Zen Judaism moment. Beyond Valium, peace is knowing one's child is an internist. And is one Nobel Prize so much to ask for from a child after all I've done? That was Zen Judaism for this first Too Jewish show of 2019, two classic haikus for Jews. If you have a question, comment, compliment, or criticism, kvetch or kvel, please email us at twojewishradio18@gmail.com. That's TOOJewishRadio18@gmail. Or visit our website at twojewishradio.com. You can hear all past and present shows through the website, streaming us from there or downloading us from the Apple iTunes Store as very popular Jewish podcasts. We welcome Amir Eden, head of the Weintraub Israel Center, our maven on Israel. Boker Tov, Amir.
Boker Tov, Rabbi.
So there's an event coming up in a couple of days on the 8th of January at the Jewish Community Center with a very interesting film. Tell us about it.
Right. So the movie is called The Driver is Red. And the theme is it's about the capture of Adolf Eichmann in Argentina by the Mossad, the Israeli Mossad.
The architect of the Final Solution,
right.
One of the really remarkable stories that captured,
right.
one of the things that really made the Mossad's reputation, actually.
Yeah, and was brought to Israel and was put on trial. So there's a movie, and the movie is short. It's only 15 minutes, and after that, there's going to be a very interesting discussion. Credit goes to the Northwest Jewish Federation. The team there brought, you know, is bringing on Tuesday, January 8th at 7 p.m. at the Federation. Not their office, but ours here on the river.
Okay. At the actual Federation on River Road.
I don't want people to go to the wrong place.
No, you don't.
Yes.
So, you know, it's very interesting, the perception of the capture of Eichmann. And there are people still alive who were involved in that.
Correct. Not all, though. People. Not
no,
all,
no,
but
of course,
yes, some.
This is around 1960 when this took place. Mm-hmm. It's a fascinating episode because it involved really international intrigue and getting a plane out of Argentina, which was not, you know, a country favorable to Israel at the time. Mm-hmm. And the trial, of course, was the only capital crimes trial that ever took place.
Correct.
In Israel. Israel doesn't have the death penalty.
Only Nazis, yes.
They passed a specific law that let them execute Eichmann.
They did. What makes the movie special, not only the length, but it's animated. So it's really the first movie that is, and I heard there's a good chance it's going to go to the Oscars. I mean, it's really good.
Won
one of the festivals, Sundance, I think.
Mm-hmm.
And so the discussion that will follow the movie will not only be on capturing Eichmann, but actually on anti-Semitism here in the United States. What is that we can do, you know, and how we can make sure it doesn't happen again.
Fascinating. And unfortunately, of course, there's been an increase in anti-Semitism, particularly in the last couple of years.
Correct.
Terrible incident at the Tree of Life Synagogue in Pittsburgh, the worst anti-Semitic attack in American history.
Yes.
So we have a lot to talk about and think about.
Right, and it really is a good opportunity for high school students to attend as well.
Open to everyone, and that'll be
free of charge.
Free of charge on the 8th, 7
Tuesday.
P.m. at the Federation Building.
At the Federation Building,
probably the Poses Room there.
Yes.
Thanks so much, Amir. We will talk next week.
Thanks, Rabbi.
We welcome our expert on the international Jewish scene, Tom Price. Happy New Year. Good morning, Tom.
Good morning, Rabbi.
We've been talking the last couple of weeks about some locations you're going to be leading a tour to in about 5 or 6 months, to Andalusia in Spain and to Morocco. Moroccan Jewish community is such a fascinating one. Tell us a little bit about the Moroccan Jewish community and what you expect to see in 2019 there.
Okay, with pleasure. So the Moroccan Jewish community is multifaceted and multi-layered.
And multilingual, we might also add.
Jews arrived in different waves of immigration and developed different cultures, and they all coexisted, especially in the big city, Casablanca, which still has a pretty sizable Jewish community, like over 10,000, several active synagogues.
Big Jewish center there, actually.
And the only Jewish museum in any Arab country. Very notable distinction. And that distinction reflects the fact that the kings of Morocco have almost always, certainly in recent centuries, been very protective toward the Jewish community of Morocco, and in fact usually created the Jewish quarter in the shadow of the palace. In all the imperial cities, Rabat, Meknes, Fez, and Marrakesh, the Jewish quarter, which is known as the Melah, is like right next to the king's palace. First of all, so the king could protect them. Second of all, he trusted them more to be loyal than he trusted his Arab and Berber citizens. And so he gave them the monopoly over the salt trade with the Sahara. And in Hebrew, salt is melach, and that became the name of what wasn't really a ghetto in the sense that Jews lived in ghettos in Central Europe, in Catholic Europe. Right. Yeah, sort of the Jewish neighborhood, but where there were certain protections and there was a concentration of synagogues and kosher butcher shops and all of that.
Fascinating about Melach being the reason for that
right.
name. Yep.
So we will see. We are only going to Fez and Marrakesh, and both cities have ancient Melachs, and both have very well kept up Jewish cemeteries. Fez has a tiny, tiny Jewish community, like no active synagogue or anything. Maybe 3 dozen Jews are left in Fez, but they guard the cemetery and the synagogues, one of which was restored with German money, sort of German guilt money over the Holocaust. And in Marrakesh, the numbers are slightly greater. There are a lot of Jews involved in the tourist industry in Marrakesh, Moroccan Jews, French Jews, whatever. And they actually do have an active synagogue and an active cemetery and some degree of community life. It's small. It's much, much smaller than Casablanca, but it's enough to sustain an active synagogue. What's really interesting over time is all the linkages between the history of the Jews of Morocco and the history of the Jews of Spain. At one point, both places were part of the Roman Empire, so they were different provinces ruled by the same people in the same city with the same language and the same currency. At another point, roughly 1,000 years later, there were 2 waves of Islamic fundamentalists who came from Morocco into Spain, upset the balance and the convivencia between Jews and Muslims in Spain. But ironically, many of the Jews who left Spain as a result of that ended up in Morocco and created like thriving communities, particularly in places like Fez, which right. were big intellectual centers in the Jewish world.
Maimonides, I mean, other people who fled that kind of Islamic fundamentalism, which should sound familiar to us today. Ended up in Morocco and creating that incredible community. Tom, I think we have to continue this next week.
All right.
We will do so. Thanks so much.
In the meanwhile, happy birthday.
Thank you. It's time now for our old Jewish joke of the week. Jewish humor, your Bubby and Zadie knew, brought to you by Too Jewish as a public service. Sadie is 70 years old and unmarried, yet she desperately wants a baby of her own. So, with the help of modern medicine and a renowned fertility specialist, Sadie has a miracle baby. When she gets home from the hospital, all her friends and relatives come to see her and meet the newest member of her family. But when they ask to see the baby, Sadie says, not yet. A little later, the relatives ask again to see the baby, and again Sadie says, not yet. Finally, her relatives ask, so look, Sadie, when can we see the baby? And Sadie replies, when the baby cries. Why do we have to wait till the baby cries, they say. And Sadie replies, because I forgot where I put it. That was the old Jewish joke of the week, special feature Too Jewish, just for you. You should live and be well. We welcome our Shin Shini Yod, our young representatives of the Weintraub Israel Center, Rotem Rapoport and Ron Benekot, some of whom have a little bit of a throat thing going on right now.
Yeah,
today.
Yeah, I'm sorry.
I know about that. That's okay. You guys are going back to Israel, and then you come back. You have a few couple of times in the year when you get to go back. When you ultimately go back, when you return from this Shnat Shirut, this year of service that you're doing, fulfilling here at Shin Shini Yod, representing Israel in America, you will go into the military, which is what almost all Israeli young people want to do. It's kind of your path to your future. How do you go about doing the testing and that sort of thing when you're not in the country? Like, do you do it in advance? How does it all work? Because I know that the IDF has very specific exams for all kinds of different jobs. Tell us about that.
For the most part, you're supposed to do your tests in your senior year. Mm-hmm. And if you don't pass any of the tests, they give you a job that doesn't require classifications. But if you're doing Shnat Shirut, a year of service, you get the chance to do more tests on your Shnat Shirut. For us, it's a little bit more difficult because we're not in Israel.
Right, you're not doing your Shnat Shirut in the Galil or in Jerusalem or somewhere or in Chof Ashkelon. You're doing it in Tucson, Arizona, long way away.
Yeah, so for the Jewish agency, Shin Shinim, it's a little more hard to do tests because we're not in Israel to do it. So most people all do it and their vacation in Israel when we have in the middle of the year, or they just get a job that doesn't require classifications.
So give me an example. What are some of the jobs that require a classification?
It's just, there's a lot of jobs in the Modi'in.
So the information services, in other words, intelligence, we would say, actually, right?
Yes, a lot of them require tests. There's a lot of tests that in the Air Force, I think, that require tests. It depends because there's so many jobs in the military, and they're really good jobs without tests, and it's just there's a very long list.
Still, I assume that it's a challenge. You want to test for the kind of job that's maybe a little bit more challenging, maybe a little more prestigious as well.
Right, we do, and it is a thing that every teenager in Israel go through. And it's always, you know, like an experience to go and do the tests and to see if you got in or didn't. But I hope that we are going to get some time while we're going to go back to visit that maybe we can do and finish those tests and maybe it could help us.
I'll do the best I can. I understand the bureaucracy of the military in Israel is just like every bureaucracy in the world. Really,
right? Exactly.
Really difficult to wind your way through. So listen, Bahatzlacha. I hope you're able to take the testing and get the kind of positions that you want in the military when you go back eventually. We will talk next week.
Bye-bye.
And now a word of Torah. This week's portion of Bo features the actual Exodus from Egypt. This climactic text is very familiar from Pesach Seders and movies, but it is no less dramatic for familiarity. Moses and Aaron warn Pharaoh this final plague is coming. God tells the Israelites to sacrifice a lamb, put its blood on the doorpost to protect themselves from the coming calamity. At midnight, the angel of death visits the homes of every Egyptian, from the Pharaoh on his throne to the prisoner in the dungeon, and the firstborn male son of each household dies. Even the livestock lose their firstborn. After long refusing freedom to the Israelites, after 10 plagues and every underhanded manipulation he could invent, the Pharaoh finally surrenders. He literally throws the Israelites out of Egypt, saying, "Go away!" There's an ironic twist at the end of this freedom narrative in Bo. Even before the Pharaoh's fruitless quest to recapture the Israelites at the sea ends badly for the Egyptians in next week's portion of B'Shalach, Pharaoh has already ordered Moses and Aaron to leave his land. But before they go, he says, "Be gone, but bless me first." This is a strange thing to say to an enemy to whom you are now essentially surrendering. Get out now, but before you go, give me a blessing. There is pathos in this request. Pharaoh has been an arrogant and magnificently stubborn opponent. Moses' request was for religious freedom for the Israelite slaves, just 3 days to worship God in their own Hebrew fashion. Rejecting even this simple plea, Pharaoh instead multiplied the slaves' work and reduced their supplies, increased their misery in the time-honored tradition of every union-busting tyrant in history. And now Pharaoh's combination of arrogance and egotism has brought death to his country and to his family. Even Pharaoh's own eldest son, his designated successor, has just died. So now he says to his antagonists, Moses and Aaron, "Bless me too?" Interestingly, the Torah does not record Moses' response to this strange request. Did Moses offer a prayer for Pharaoh? If so, what's the suitable blessing for a brutal, genocidal God-king? Was it a mourning prayer for his dead son? Or was it more like the rabbi on Fiddler on the Roof? "May God bless and keep the Pharaoh far away from us." Finally, after 9 plagues worth of direct evidence, the overwhelming power of Moses' God has become clear, even to this human representative of Egypt's polytheistic gods, a man who believes himself to be divine. In that surrender, a little bit of humanity from Pharaoh peeks through. "My gods have been discredited, my blessings and curses overthrown. In my mourning, in my confusion, in my despair, I need a blessing from my worst enemy." There's something peculiarly human about this, just as true today as over 3,000 years ago in Moses and Pharaoh's time. Often in life we seek blessing not from those who support us and agree with us or love us, but from those who don't. We long for the respect, maybe even the love, of those who are hardest to please and least likely to accept us. Sometimes the approval or admiration of our enemies ranks even higher in our estimation than the steady praise of our acolytes. You know, as Jews, we know this odd motivation well. How often we struggle with the need for approval from figures who do not give it easily. With the lack of unconditional parental love, the absence of regard from those from whom we most need it, the near desperate desire to be accepted. It is not to say that Pharaoh is a needy Jewish child, or Moses an uncaring Jewish father or mother. The Pharaoh of this story is a megalomaniac tyrant, but apparently megalomaniac tyrants have emotional needs too, don't they? Even in a warped person, that human need for approval remains. In a story filled with drama and power, the plaintive request, "Bless me too," adds a human note. We all need to find blessing. Pharaoh never does. He soon regrets his weakening, chases the Israelites to further his own ruin, but perhaps we, who have done much less wrong than Pharaoh, and who need blessing at least as much, perhaps we will be able to find it in our own lives. When we return on To Jewish, our guest, Rabbi Ann Brenner, will explore how we can learn to address loss and how Jewish traditions provide insight, meaning, and comfort at times of deepest mourning. Find out how to cope when we come back in a moment here on To Jewish.
We continue with our To Jewish update on news of Jews around the world with commentary.
Last week, embattled Israeli Prime Minister Bibi Netanyahu went on a state visit to Brazil, first for an Israeli leader since the founding of the state. In the course of the visit, Netanyahu and the new Brazilian president, Jair Bolsonaro, agreed that Brazil will move its embassy from Tel Aviv to Jerusalem sometime soon. During this historic visit, timed to coincide with the inauguration of Bolsonaro, Honduras agreed to move its embassy to Jerusalem, following its Central American neighbor, Guatemala, that did so back in May of 2018. The Women's March is experiencing pushback because of the anti-Semitic views and connections of some of its founders and leaders. New Orleans last week canceled its version of the Women's March, saying many of the sister marches have asked the leaders of the Women's March, Inc. to resign, but as of today, they have not yet done so. Three of the executive leaders of the main Women's March organization have been accused of engaging in or condoning anti-Semitism, retaining close ties with Nation of Islam leader Louis Farrakhan, a virulent anti-Semite, and of failing to heed the concerns of its thousands of Jewish backers. The controversy is dampening efforts of sister marches to fundraise, enlist involvement, find sponsors, and attendee numbers have drastically declined this year. New Orleans is no exception, said the chapter. New Orleans held her Women's March for the past 2 years. Chicago also recently canceled its Women's March. Marches remain scheduled in many communities across the country on January 19th, while Linda Sarsour, Tamika Mallory, and Carla Perez, who have all made anti-Semitic comments, and also many of them have ties to Farrakhan and other anti-Semites, they remain in the executive leadership group of the Women's March still. The great Israeli author and past guest of Two Jewish, Amos Oz, died last week, just before the new secular year. He was 79. Oz wrote 40 books, including 14 novels, plus hundreds of published articles and essays. As author Thane Rosenbaum eulogized him, Amos Oz was Israel's first great native man of letters, an old-school public intellectual in a brand-new nation with many jobs to fill, from the brawny to the brainy. Those patriarchs and matriarchs like Oz made the saying, next year in Jerusalem, both a reality and a redundancy. With little natural background, they willed themselves to become equal parts poets, farmers, and soldiers. Amos Oz was a living embodiment of those multiple duties. After his mother's suicide, the year before his bar mitzvah, he came of age on a kibbutz and fought in two of Israel's wars. He published acclaimed novels such as My Michael and Black Box, as well as a literary memoir, A Tale of Love and Darkness, that captured the finer points of domestic Israeli life, the yearnings and sexual passions and the madness of a people who reinvented themselves so soon after nearly being annihilated. He was also a political activist, a founder of Peace Now, who believed in the possibility for peace till the end of his life. I met Amos Oz a couple of times and interviewed him in person for Two Jewish. He was honest, open, tough, and memorable. Amos Oz dressed like a kibbutznik, spoke plainly but eloquently, and understood modern Israel in a way few people ever have, and he wrote about it brilliantly. He was a truly great Israeli and a Jew, and he will be greatly missed. And Super Dave Osborne's final stunt is done now. Those stunts always went wrong, of course.
Spectacular, Super Dave, spectacular. I don't know what else to say.
How about get a Dr. Putz? I'm in a lot of pain.
Thank you, Super Dave. Mike, now, this is Mike Walden returning you to John Biner and Bazaar.
Help me, Mike.
Nice job, Dave.
Mike.
Super Dave, nice
help
going.
Help me, Mike.
What is that noise?
Comedian Bob Einstein, famous for his satirical daredevil character Super Dave Osborne in the 80s and 90s, who later became Larry David's friend Marty Funkhauser on Curb Your Enthusiasm and Larry Middleman on Arrested Development. Bob Einstein died last week. He was 76. He was the older brother of comedian, filmmaker, and actor Albert Brooks. Einstein parodied Evel Knievel in a long career of very funny shticks, starting in Canada, in which he always got crushed doing the fake stunts. He was often hilariously funny. Thank you for making us laugh. Lech l'shalom, Super Dave. And that's the Two Jewish News of Jews Around the World. We welcome back our guest this morning. Rabbi Ann Brenner is the author of the classic and now renewed Mourning and Mitzvah. The 25th anniversary edition has been published, a guided journal for walking the mourner's path through grief to healing. Has over 75 guided exercises. Rabbi Brenner is also an LCSW with extensive experience in counseling and in healing those in the throes of grief and mourning. I want to talk a little bit about sort of how it's different dealing with grief in times of great tragedy. It's always difficult to lose someone you love, but we have seen so many awful events in the past years, as Jews, we think particularly the Tree of Life massacre in Pittsburgh not long ago. Tell us what insights you feel you can bring to those kinds of mourning situations.
Our rituals provide us with an understanding of many things, and one of them is that grief changes over time. Another is that people die in the middle of a conversation, and it's essential for us to find a way to continue that conversation, because if we don't, a part of us also dies, a part of us that lived in the conversation with either the person or the situation that we're mourning has to find a way to express itself, and we provide rituals in which that's possible.
So that's why we have Yisker four times a year. We have a yard site, you know, a time to kind of renew it at different seasons. And I hadn't really thought about it this way, but to redo that conversation in a way.
Right, and to allow people to acknowledge that, you know, the year's up, but there's still work to do. As well as, if you look at the 4 days on which Yisker is recited, they correspond with four different tasks of grief. And there's a Yisker, the first one of the year, takes place on Yom Kippur afternoon. And Yom Kippur is a time when we're looking at unfinished business between ourselves and other people or between ourselves and God. It's also called Yom HaKippurim, and the belief is that it's not just our souls for which we're doing the atonement. We're also atoning for the souls of people who are gone. So it gives us an opportunity to really look at where we were in the conversation, what didn't get said, what needed to get to be said, what couldn't be said, and to try to find the words to clear any of the, for want of a better word, schmutz.
Yeah.
Schmutz that,
it's the
that,
right word,
that,
I think.
That might have... that might have appeared, that might have been present in the relationship, so right. That as the years go by, it'll be easier and easier to feel connected.
I want to play devil's
without
advocate.
Without any of the unfinished business. The next day, can I just...
Sure, go ahead.
All these the next day that that we say Yisker is everybody's favorite holiday, Shemini Atzeret. Which most people have never heard of, but what it actually is the day after Sukkot. The legend is that in the time of the temple, the rituals for Sukkot were just so wonderful that people came, not only the people who would later be called Jews, but people came from all over the ancient world to take part of it. And then on the last day, everybody would go home. But the legend is that God said to the Israelites, don't go, and let's stay for another day. So that don't go certainly corresponds to a feeling that most people have after someone's died. And in addition, the big change, the most significant change that happens on Shemini Atzeret is that the liturgy changes, and instead of praying for dew, we pray for rain. And of course, rain is a wonderful metaphor for the tears that just have to fall if we're going to really acknowledge our grief. And when those tears fall, and when the rain comes, we know that the seeds in the earth are germinated, and the stones in our heart begin to melt. So the Yisker of Shemini Atzeret gives us that opportunity. Then the next day that we say Yisker is on Pesach, the eighth day of Pesach, and of course Passover is our holiday where we celebrate freedom. And I think that all of us, no matter how good a relationship may have been, or how difficult a relationship may have been, are somehow in its thrall. Until we are ready to move on. So Passover asks the question, how are you still living in someone else's land? How are you still performing the agenda of people who are gone and really not living freely as your own person? So that's the work of Pesach. In my book, I cover this much more extensively.
And quite beautifully, I might add.
Oh, thank you. And then finally, the fourth day of Yisker is Shavuot, which is a day where we celebrate the giving of the Torah. And in terms of our grief, it's a good time to look at what were the gifts. What was the Torah of the relationship? What was the Torah of remembering the relationship? What did we really learn in this relationship that has now done the very difficult thing of changing from the physical world to a connection and that is spiritual? And I think that that these 4 days, if they're fully observed, and explored, give us the opportunity for transforming, doing the hardest things that humans ever have to do, which is transform our physical connection to a spiritual connection, and find peace in that.
I want to address something you said, which is that people are more comfortable talking about spirituality. So it seems to me in America, for a long time. Most of us have nothing to do with death. If you don't kill an animal, you go buy meat in a plastic package if you eat meat. You don't see people die. They go off to hospice or they're in a hospital. They don't die at home so much. That we are kind of divorced from this experience of death. Do you see that changing? I guess I see it going both ways. I see as we age as a population, we become more familiar with it. But I also see people waiting to do funerals, not following Jewish practice, doing a celebration of life 6 months later when it's convenient for people to come. What do you see happening overall in society?
Well, I think that slowly the denial of death is being chipped away, but not fast enough. I mean, I think that our whole culture is rooted, Western culture, not Jewish culture, is rooted in this denial of death. It allows us to pretend that we can just do anything we want and things will stay the same. We can dump all of our garbage into the ocean, but we're not going to kill the ocean. Or we can build these buildings that go up to the sky, sort of our modern day Babel, and put our names on it, and it'll be permanent. But I think that Judaism has a real understanding that things are never permanent. I think that one of the most precious spiritual teachings in Judaism is the teaching of living in a sukkah. During Sukkot, we are commanded to live in fragile structures where we are vulnerable, and it's called Zman Simchatenu, the time of our joy. I mean, to me, that is absolutely one of the most potent spiritual images, this paradox of being vulnerable and being joyous at the same time. I think that this is something that very much underscores the fact that things are always changing, that we're always vulnerable. Any place that we ever live is a sukkah, and life is fragile, and life changes, and people die, and it can hurt. And this is not what our culture has tried to tell us. And because of this, I think it has implications that are political and environmental and is very dangerous. Because I think that people who fully grieve, people who help people grieve, in Judaism one of the practices is that we wash bodies. People in the community wash the body after a person has died and prepare it for burial.
The whole Chevra Kedisha concept, of course, right?
Right. People who come face to face with death take life more seriously. You know, Sam, when I was first writing my book, there was a part of me that was a little embarrassed because, who wants to deal with death? Was sort of the message that I was getting over and over again. But one day, and I did a lot of the book. I was actually would be jogging and dictating into a tape recorder, and one day I was doing this, and all of a sudden it occurred to me, this is not a book about death. It's a book about living, about life, and about living in a world that doesn't deny death and allows people to embrace life in its fullness, and so take life seriously, recognize that our time here is finite, so how do we make the most of it? How do we stop procrastinating and really live fully? I think that the denial of death that just pervades our culture, well, you know, some people trace it back to the First World War, when the death was just so overwhelming that people just didn't know what to do. They just couldn't face it. And certainly for the Jewish people, after the Second World War, and the horrors that our people faced in the Holocaust, you know, it was just so overwhelmingly painful that people couldn't really talk about it. And so much of Judaism at that time began to focus on not an esoteric Judaism, but an exoteric Judaism, a Judaism that was about building buildings and building Israel and saying not just to the world but to ourselves, we're still here, we're still here. And so people didn't dare feel the tender, confused feelings that mourners feel, where certainly they're in confusion about God and they're confusion about all the existential issues that grief raises. It was just too painful and too pervasive. So people just held their breaths and did what they could to build a structure that at this point I think can now hold the difficulties that people have to feel and not deny them, and to allow people the opportunity to fully grieve.
The book is called Mourning and Mitzvah. It's available from Jewish Lights Publishing. You can, I believe, find it on Amazon, where you can find everything known to humanity. I want to thank Rabbi Ann Brenner for a great visit here on Two Jewish. I feel like we're just beginning, but we're out of time. And I want to tell you, if you want to know how to deal with grief and mourning, this is one of the great ways to do so. Where else can people go to find out more about you, to find out more about your book?
Well, you know, the book is, as you said, very much available online. They can reach me at Rabbi Ann Brenner, and Ann has an E and Brenner has two N's, one N.
One N. I think Brenner, you know, I think you spell your name with one N. B-R-E-N-E-R.
I do. And people try to find me forever with two N's, and they never do.
My
father said his father couldn't afford two N's when he came to the country. On his 75th birthday, we gave him a big wooden N.
Yeah, to make up for what he couldn't, his family couldn't afford. Listen, try Cohen with two O's sometime and see how that goes for you.
Did I say at gmail.com?
Yes, Rabbi Ann Brenner, A-N-N-E-B-R-E-N-E-R @gmail.com. Thanks so much.
Oh, thank you, Sam, and congratulations on what you're doing. It's really good.
When we come back on Two Jewish, we'll hear about next week's guest get a final musical play out.
There's magic in the air at this special place for fun, a place where fortune smiles and Tucson comes alive. This is Casino del Sol. The best games in town, amazing dining, and top-flight entertainment. This is a heart that beats with excitement, with passion and beauty. It's all waiting for you at Casino del Sol. This is the soul of Tucson. Presenting sponsor of University of Arizona Basketball, Enterprise of the Pascua-Yaki Tribe.
Thanks for being here with us this morning on Two Jewish with me, Rabbi Sam Cohan. Join us next Sunday. Our guest on Two Jewish will be a new Grammy nominee, Professor Anna Sternschuss, who has rescued the Yiddish songs of the Russian Jews during World War II and now has been nominated for the music industry's highest, glitziest award. Hear her remarkable story next Sunday on Two Jewish. And of course, listen to all of our podcasts on iTunes, at our twojewishradio.com website, top 10 Jewish podcasts in America, according to Moment magazine. Our playout this morning comes from next week's guest's collection of Yiddish music, the album Yiddish Glory, The Lost Songs of World War II. It's called Nitzachenlied, The Victory Song. My friends, may you have a great secular new year, a Shavua Tov, a good week, and a week, we pray, of peace.
Sponsored by two Jewish radio programs, Tucson, Arizona.